Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, for your presence here this evening. It truly is encouraging to me. We've had such good audiences every single night. I've been very much impressed, and my heart goes out, my thanksgiving goes out to so many of you that have driven good distances in some cases to be here with us and to encourage this effort. Tonight is the final lesson in the series of three that we have titled, When Good People Do Bad Things. Or Why Do Good People Do Bad Things? And I will not take the time to rehearse the points that we have addressed thus far. The information will be available on the CDs. But tonight we will conclude with some remarks I think will supplement the material that we've dealt with thus far. The first point I want to make tonight in considering the various reasons why people who seem to be good do a radical change and therefore become inexplicably evil. And we try to probe our minds, we try to analyze the situation and wonder what has happened. Many times we simply cannot figure it out. But we can introduce some Bible truths, some sacred principles that certainly will play into the equation as to why people make such drastic and damnable decisions in their lives, thus changing the direction from heaven to hell. The first point that I want to make tonight is what I would call the eroding conscience that so many people let themselves get into. I mentioned in one of the previous lessons that the conscience is one of those special gifts from God that makes us human beings unique of all biological creatures upon this earth. Animals do not have a conscience, but human beings do. How is the conscience to be defined? The conscience is a part of that package referred to in Genesis 1, 26 and 27, wherein the scriptures state that we have been made in the image of God. As I observed earlier, this cannot have to do with any kind of physical image, because God is not physical. But it has to do with spiritual qualities. The conscience can be defined as that sense within us, that essence that we have as a part of the human rationale that says there is right and there is wrong. And they are opposites. Now, the conscience does not tell you what is right and what is wrong. The conscience is merely a compass to point you in the direction of seeking additional information so that you may be at ease with your conscience. Paul refers to this concept of the conscience in the second chapter of the book of Romans, about verse 14, where he is discussing the fact that the ancient Gentile world had no revelation from God in a written form, unlike the Jews, who possessed the law of Moses. Rather, he says, nonetheless, the Gentiles were held accountable because they had consciences. And their consciences either accused or excused them. That is, depending upon the standard that a person adopts with reference to his lifestyle, his conscience will condemn him, or his conscience will bless him and excuse him in the activity that he's involved in. I would dare say without any controversy that those of us here tonight who are worshiping God and studying from His holy word at this hour have good consciences. We feel comfortable with what we're doing because we know that we are pleasing God. On the other hand, if we were walking the streets out here using drugs, imbibing alcohol, selling our bodies for sexual purposes, our consciences would be bothering us because we know intrinsically that such things of that nature are not consistent with the will of God. So the conscience is a very special thing that you have, and you need to cultivate it very carefully and do not abuse it, because it can become deadened and thus become your enemy as opposed to being your friend. Now, I mentioned already that the conscience does not tell you what the truth is. It merely says there is truth and there is error. In Proverbs chapter 14 and about verse 12, the wise man said there is a way that seems right to a man, but the end are the ways of death. The Apostle Paul, beginning in Acts chapter 23, making one of his great defenses, said that, "I have lived in all good conscience unto this day." Well, as every child knows, the Apostle Paul had been a vicious persecutor of Christianity, even when they came to trial, casting his vote against them and causing them to be executed. Nonetheless, he thought all the while that he was doing the will of God, but he was wrong, and he needed to be confronted by Christ and converted to the truth and have his conscience tuned up with more correct information. But there is a great deal of information in the Bible about how we can misuse and erode our consciences to reach the point where they no longer are sensitive as warning lights to us for misconduct. You are familiar in the Old Testament with the narrative concerning Pharaoh. A number of times in the Old Testament, as God sent Moses, his servant, down into the land of Egypt to deliver the Israelite people who had been in bondage for several centuries, the record says that as Moses gave the charge to him, "Thus saith Jehovah the God of Israel, let my people go," that Pharaoh hardened his heart. God began to send various plagues to chastise the king and the nation. At times, he would purpose to let the Israelites go, but then he would relent. And the text will say he hardened his heart. Curiously, along the way, various passages state that God hardened his heart. Is there any contradiction between the two texts? No, not at all. God hardened his heart in this way, by making demands upon him that were contrary to what he perceived as his own personal interest. He did not want to allow 2 to 3 million Hebrew slaves leave his grasp. What an economic burden that would place upon the Egyptian regime. And so when God made the demands, "Let my people go," he said no. He would relent under the heavy hand of a plague, but then harden his heart. And so we need to learn from Pharaoh the negative lesson that if you don't cultivate your heart, your conscience, and keep it tender and sensitive to the will of God, It can become hardened. In the New Testament, when Paul writes to the church at Ephesus, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 19, he describes certain of the pagan world, the Gentiles of that era. And you ought to underline this phrase in your Bible. He says regarding many of these people that they have become past feeling. Get that, please. What does it mean? The phrase means they have dredged so deeply down into the abyss of wounding their conscience over and over and over again, ignoring its warnings, that they no longer can feel. They cannot feel any longer. That is a sorry state of affairs to be in. I have watched on television from time to time some of these champion karate experts. And it just blows my mind how that they can stack up brick old blocks so high and then whoop themselves up and come down with their hands and break all of those things. And I'm sure there must be some pain involved in that. But not nearly so much as if it were you or I trying that exercise. And why is that the case? Because through much abuse, they have hardened their hands so that they cannot feel the pain as an ordinary person would. I want you to listen to the words of the Apostle Paul when he writes his first letter to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 4. Beginning in verse 1, he says, "Now the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons through the hypocrisy of men that speak lies, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from meats." In connection with that, he says this, listen to it, "branded in their own consciences as with a hot iron." Or another translation reads like this, "seared in their own consciences as with a hot iron." The Greek word comes over into English in a term that we recognize readily. It's the word cauterize. You remember back in the old days of the West when somebody would get a bullet wound and they were out somewhere where they could not have adequate medical attention and they stuck a branding iron or a poker or something in the fire and got it red hot and put on the wound, cauterizing it. And it's just as hard as it can be. The nerves are killed. And the apostle said the days are coming when people's hearts would be branded or seared or cauterized and reach a state where sensitivity is gone. There's an interesting passage in the book of Hebrews that I reflect upon from time to time. Chapter 5 and verse 14, I believe it is, where the inspired writer said that we need to, listen to this, we need to exercise our senses that they may be able to determine good and evil. Our senses are the elements of our conscience. Interestingly, the word exercise comes from a Greek word which brought over into English is gymnasium, and a place where you go and exercise. And so he says, exercise your conscience. Keep it sharp, that it might be able to prick you when you do wrong, bless you when you do right, and keep you in the straight and narrow path. On March the 6th, A man by the name of Richard Kuklinski died in a prison hospital ward in Boston. I have been studying Mr. Kuklinski for probably 2 or 3 years. I saw some television specials regarding him that intrigued my interest. I have observed them probably 3 or 4 times. Richard Kuklinski was born into a Roman Catholic family. As a boy, he was an altar boy, religiously inclined. But he had a brutal dad who beat him frequently. He said that his dad would come in from work and for no reason at all would slap him or get a strap and beat him. Not for anything he had done, but simply because he thought every boy needed a good whipping frequently to drive the meanness out of him. Well, he hardened young Richard. He was picked on quite a bit at school. He decided one day that he would not be picked on any longer and that he would be the picker-oner instead of the recipient of abuse. When he was 18 years old, he killed his first person. It bothered him, he said, a bit. He wrestled with it for a while. But then somehow or another, someone else aggravated him, and he got the urge to do it again. And so he killed another. It didn't bother him nearly so much, he said, the second time. He then began to sort of enjoy the exercise, and he killed again and again. Before long, his notoriety came to the attention of certain individuals who were a part of the mafia. And by and by, they employed him to be a professional hitman. During his career, before he was arrested finally, he had killed known victims 125. Now, he was known as the Iceman. If you want to sometime, go to the public library and check out the video on the Iceman. It's a long, extended interview, a psychological profile of the Iceman. Now, he was known as the Iceman because he frequently froze the bodies of his victims so that the coroner could not precisely identify the time of their death. But eventually, that nickname took because, figuratively speaking, it was supposed that he had ice water in his veins. You understand the meaning of that expression. He came to enjoy murder so much that he experimented with all different kinds of ways of killing individuals. One example that I vividly remember, in which there was some video, he videoed the actual murder. He took a victim and put him in a cave and covered him with some kind of sweet substance and let the rats come and eat him to death. He says regarding one murder, I don't want to go on too long with this, but I want to mention this. He says regarding one of his victims, the gentleman fell down on his knees and begged him not to kill him. And then he began to pray, "Oh God, God, please save me." And Kuklinski said that he said to the man, "I'm looking at my watch. I'm going to give you 30 minutes to pray to your God. If he comes and saves you, then you'll be saved. If he doesn't, I'm going to kill you." And he sat there with the clock, looking as the minutes ticked off. And the man kept crying and praying. And then he said, "Your time is up." And he killed him. Now, the reason I mention this is I was absolutely mesmerized by looking at the face of this man as this long, in one episode, a 2-hour interview with the Iceman. I have never seen eyes that looked like there was nobody at home behind them. He had a glaze and a gaze that was penetrating. Now, he was being interviewed in prison, and not terribly long before he died, a couple of years perhaps. And the thing that struck me was this. He said, "I have absolutely no regret and no remorse over anyone I have ever killed." He had a wife, children who loved him, knew not about his secret life. It's possible for an individual who blunts his conscience over and over again to become a Kuklinski to some degree. Every time you do something that you know is wrong, every time that you refrain from doing something that you know is right, you dull your conscience. And a lot of people reach the point of no return, to where they reach that stage where they have gone so far that they listen no more to their conscience. And then you see a person who perhaps once was good, but now is headed the opposite direction. Why? Because of the gradual erosion of the conscience. I'm going to tell you how important that is. This is. In Romans chapter 14, the Apostle Paul deals with the matter of the conscience. And he talks about certain individuals in the church, for example, who are weak, and they eat meat that's been sacrificed to an idol. And even though there's nothing intrinsically wrong with doing that, because meat is simply meat, and it's not tainted by what people have done with it. It might have been offered to an idol and then sold in the marketplace. But he says, if that individual is weak and he believes that there is some kind of spiritual taint to eating that meat, he is not to eat it. He needs to study and learn more. And then only when his mind is clear on the issue can he then partake of that. He concludes that chapter by saying in about verse 23, "Whatsoever is not of faith is sin." And that means this. If you can't do it with a clear conscience, even though there may be nothing basically wrong with it, if you do it and violate your conscience, you have sinned against God. That's just how serious it is to damage your conscience. Well, let me go on to another point. The next point that I would introduce with reference to why good people become bad people would simply be the fundamental reality of the company which they keep, the companionship into which they fall. The Apostle Paul expressed it like this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33. Hear him. "Evil companionships corrupt good morals." Actually, the apostle is quoting from a Greek playwright. And if you look at the passage in the original classical piece of literature, this playwright, Menander, was warning young men about making friendships with prostitutes, that it would lead them down the wrong road. And so the context of the passage is evil companionships will corrupt your morality. There's a good principle there. You are who you run with, or generally you will become like whom you run with. I say this with reference to our friends, and we need to recognize the fact that the Bible teaches we are the light of the world and we are the salt of the earth, and we are to be exercising our influence over other people. That means with some degree of familiarity, we need to make friends of those who are our friends and neighbors, our business associates, our schoolmates, whatever. But anytime you see that another person's influence over you is greater than yours over them, you'd better change friends. You better get away from that situation, because evil companionships corrupt good morals. There is a book that has been written called The Man Nobody Knows by Bruce Barton. Really, it's a life of Christ. And he, at one time, was an atheist, but he became, quote, converted and became impressed with Christianity and our Lord Jesus Christ, though I have no evidence and do not believe that he was ever converted according to the true plan of salvation. Nonetheless, he wrote a beautiful biography of Christ. He was a master with the use of the language. And I never shall forget reading the episode that he wrote regarding Jesus' parable of the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. A father had two sons, he said, and he loved those two sons like he loved his two eyes or his two hands. But one day the younger son came to him and said, "Father, give me the portion of the inheritance that falls to me." He describes the old gentleman as probably turning away and going off by himself for a while, tears streaming down his face, knowing his young son was not ready to face the world. His heart was throbbing. He did not know what to do. He knew, though, that perhaps his son would have to exercise his own decisions, his own choices. And so though he loved him, though he would preferred to have forced him to stay, he did not. And you know who the Father is. That's God. He lets us have and exercise our own freedom of choice. And so he says the son went off, the Bible says, into a far country. And I want to tell you, whenever you leave God, you're going into a far country. The record says that he spent and wasted his substance in riotous living. When he came back home, his older brother accused him. Whether that was factual or not, he accused him of spending a lot of money on harlots. Anyway, Bruce Barton describes how he must have had a lot of friends gather around him when they saw that his money bags were bulging. Fair weather friends, not genuine friends. And he mingled with those friends who brought him down and corroded him until he was forced, as a Jew, mind you, to get a job slopping hogs, caring for pigs in a pig pen, the swine being unclean to the Jews. He became so hungry that he would faint, got down on all fours and ate the carob pods that the pigs required to eat. The main point he was emphasizing here was the corruption of ungodly friends. Ladies and gentlemen, it pains me deeply to think about how so many of our young people are matriculating through the public school system, which is an absolute cesspool of corruption. I'm aware of the fact that people can't afford many times to send their children to private schools. They're expensive. I recognize the fact that even though the homeschooling situation is an exploding phenomenon and is very good when people can afford to do it and are qualified to do it, and you can learn that. But I feel for people who have to have their children go to school. We didn't know any different when our children were little. When my daughter was in junior high school, the entire time she was there, she never went to the restroom. Never. It was too dangerous. One of my sons was knocked out in the hall. Someone came up behind him, just knocked him out. A dangerous situation. We have in our congregation a school teacher, a wonderful Christian lady. She said the other day, she teaches at lower levels and she teaches children that are sort of learning impaired, but she's a specialist in a general elementary school. She says one of the main problems they're having now, they're having to monitor the restroom because little children, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, go in there and the girls are experimenting with each other in the restroom and the boys similarly. It is a Sodom and Gomorrah. And do we understand the kind of influence our youngsters are under? We want them to be in sports, 40-11 dozen different sports, sports year-round. We put them in the play field, we put them in the work field, we put them in the school field, and they're associated with degenerates. Far more time than they have with their parents, certainly more time than they have in Bible school situations. And people do not wonder. Some years ago, a Christian lady told me, "I want my children in the public school because they need that kind of socialization." In recent years, she has discovered that both of her sons are into drugs, into sex, into alcohol, into pornography. They absolutely have no limits in terms of what they have done and are doing. Yes, evil companionships corrupt good morals. Now let me mention a third point just momentarily. In the Old Testament, in the book of Psalms, chapter 11 and verse 3, the psalmist said, "If the foundations be destroyed, what shall the righteous do?" The foundation is extremely important in constructing a building, in constructing a life. Jesus used a similitude in Matthew chapter 7, beginning in verse 21, about two builders. Remember that? One built his house upon the rock. Luke's account says he dug deep and built his house upon a rock. The other built his house upon the shifting sands. And the record said when the rains came and the floods came up, the house built upon the sand was washed away, but the house built upon the rock stood firm. If the foundations are not solid, what shall the righteous do? What am I talking about when I talk about foundation? Foundation truths. I'm talking about such things as, does God really exist? Or is that a myth that has been conjured up that your parents have believed all their life? But there is no real basis to it. The idea that you were not created by God, for there is no such creature. You evolve through a long process of mutations and natural selection from some lower slimy form of life. You are but an accident upon this planet. And when an individual adopts that philosophy, he has no moral standard upon which to build his life. Now, I know there are atheists who live moral lives to a considerable extent. But they, listen to this, they do not do so because of anything intrinsic to their ideology or their philosophy. They do so in spite of it. They have bootlegged a moral code from some other source because atheism has none. The French existential atheist Jean-Paul Sartre expressed it like this. Listen to him. He's an atheist. He's enunciating their philosophy. If there is no God, nothing is wrong. That means when Adolf Hitler exterminated 6 million Jews, he didn't do anything wrong. Nothing is wrong. That means when Stalin and Lenin and the other communist leaders of the former Russian regime killed over 100 million people because they did not accept communism and its atheistic roots, they didn't do anything wrong. They were just exterminating ne'er-do-wells. If the foundations be destroyed, I was told that a youngster who was, I think, a freshman in college went into a biology class. And the first day of the classroom experience, as class was about to start, he noticed a Bible on the teacher's desk. He thought that's strange. Biology teacher, a Bible on his desk. What a wonderful discovery. He presently found out otherwise. He said as the class started, the teacher walked over and took the Bible and picked it up and turned to the trash can beside his desk and threw it in there and said, "That's the last I want to hear of this book being mentioned in this class." They work to destroy the faith of young people. I've held gospel meetings all over this country and abroad. And I can tell you, I have had on any number of occasions parents come to me with tears streaming down their face saying this, "You know, Brother Jackson, my son obeyed the gospel when he was 14. And he led singing and he waited on the table. And oh, we were so proud of him. We sent him off to college. He went to the university. Now he doesn't even believe in God. Doesn't want to have anything to do with the Bible. He has no interest in church whatsoever." That is not an unusual thing for me to hear when I'm involved in a lectureship where I speak on Christian evidences quite a bit. So we need to understand then that if we don't fortify the faith of our youngsters, put something under them that will stick to their bones and carry them through the storms of their early educational period, we're going to lose them. And I'm telling you, we're losing them by the ton. I hold gospel meetings everywhere, and I want to tell you something, in many places the audience looks like a cotton field. What's that? They're all gray-headed. You see barely any youngsters at all. You may see a considerable number on Sunday morning, but they're not back Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, or whenever. They're too busy doing homework. They've got school activities. If the foundations be destroyed, what shall the righteous do? I want to then conclude with this final brief point. And I call this the illusion of security. Why do so many good people become bad? Because they really don't believe that it makes any difference. John Calvin, following the teaching of Augustine, popularized the idea that a child of God cannot do anything to be lost. No matter what he does, no matter how he lives, he will not be lost because he has been saved by the blood of Christ, and his redemption is absolutely sealed and secure. We have not subscribed to that as a body of people, theoretically. But I'll tell you what, scores of people who are members of the church have subscribed to it practically. Because they live in such a way as to evidence the fact that they don't believe that they can be lost no matter what they do or what they don't do. They are secure. The denominationalists preach it and we practice it. I have a lady that I baptized 10 years ago out of a denominational sect. And in many respects, she is a wonderful woman. Do anything for anybody. Baptized both her and her husband. He passed away a couple of years ago. She believes, and she will tell me, Wayne, I do not believe that I can be lost no matter what I do. I believe that when God saved me, He did the job. He did it right. I am saved and I cannot be lost. Now, that's a pathetic thing. A pathetic thing. The Apostle Paul said in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 4, "Ye who would be justified by the law, you are severed from Christ. You are fallen away from grace." These are the very people that he had said back in chapter 3, 26 and 27, "You are the children of God by means of the faith. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ did put Christ on." And now he says, if you try to justify yourself by the law, you're severed from Christ. Is that serious? You are fallen away from grace. Don't tell me you can't fall from grace, because you can. I want to close by reading this passage from the book of Ezekiel. I know it's Old Testament, but it contains a principle that is just as applicable now as it was in his day. Reading Ezekiel 18:24, you need to mark this, put a box around this passage. "But when the righteous turns away from his righteousness and commits iniquity, and does according to all the abominations that the wicked man does, shall he live?" That's a rhetorical question, implying a negative answer. The prophet continues, "None of his righteous deeds that he has done shall be remembered. In his trespass that he has trespassed, and in his sin that he has sinned, in them shall he die." Now that ought to make cold chills run down your spine. When a righteous man turns away from his righteousness and embraces wickedness, everything he's ever done, wouldn't it be sad for a person to live 80 years, the majority of that being faithful to the Lord, and then turn away in the last year or so and abandon God? What a waste of a life. This has been a distressing, a negative kind of presentation. And as I said the other night, it depresses me somewhat to have to be so negative about people falling away and good people becoming bad, things of that nature. But It's a grim reality of our existence. And each one of us needs to guard our own heart and soul and make a firm resolution to God tonight when you get out on your knees and pray to Him, help me to be faithful, help me to continue my resolve as long as there is a breath left in my body. You've been such a wonderfully kind and attentive audience, and I'm thankful to every single one of you. We close by extending the invitation. If you're here and you've never obeyed the gospel of the Son of God, you've never translated your faith into repentance and then into the likeness of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection by being baptized in water and raised to walk in newness of life, that you might be a New Testament Christian. If you've not done that, what's holding you back? You're lost without obedience to God's plan of salvation. We say that lovingly and as kindly as we know how, but that's a grim reality of spiritual life. If you've not been faithful, you've been negligent, you've not been diligent in the service of the Lord, you know what your heart's condition is. If your circumstances have been public and others know about it, you need to publicly confess that and make yourself right. Put yourself back into God's favor once more. If you are here, therefore, and you are touched by the gospel and you need to respond tonight and are inclined to do it, our hearts will rejoice, and so will the Lord's as you come.